I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. If you were born or raised in New England, or even if you're a transplant, you'll appreciate Sarah Stewart Payne's recent article in the New Yorker magazine titled Pilgrim's Progress on God and Real Estate. And in this piece, she nails both New England values and how brittle that New Englanders can be when outsiders sort of try to import their value system. And she joins us from Argot Studios in New York. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks. My name is actually Sarah Payne Stewart.
Oh, I got it right the first time. Sorry
okay.
about that.
I get it mixed up all the time.
So you look at Concord, Massachusetts here, where you grew up, and I have to say, I grew up in the next town over. Carlisle.
Oh, well, that's
right.
Really Concord.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a subsidiary, right? So reading it was a little bit like reading my own sort of growing up experience. But I thought one of the really interesting things is that you talked about Concord, and I think Concord in a lot of ways is emblematic of probably a lot of places, but it's always been this sort of haven for really conscientious people who you say are kind of ambivalent about having money.
Yes. What was interesting when I started researching the town I lived in was that even the Puritans, like the Pilgrims, who came to Mayflower didn't really have much money, most of them. But the guy who was the leading founder of Concord, Peter Bulkley, came with £6,000. And this is about the time when Harvard was, I think, endowed with £400. So it was this huge amount of money. And yet he felt that it was very important to do this. He went out into the wilds. He lived in a mud bunker. But he did bring a carpenter with him from England to build him eventually probably a very nice house.
So you grew up there. Talk about what the Concord of your childhood felt like, sort of what the mothers were like and what the houses were like. What kinds of values were emphasized?
Well, it was kind of great in a way because back in the 1960s, there were a lot of very rich people in Concord, but you really didn't know. Obviously everybody had some money, but they lived in the same shabby houses. It was always freezing in the winter. You didn't have a carpet for your foot to land to from the creaky bed. And there was this real sense of not showing your money. And that was kind of great, a little intimidating in some ways, but great. And then, you know, there was this sort of sense of constant judgmentalness in Concord, which is a very New England thing. And I think it's because they doubt themselves. I think all New Englanders who have been around for several generations come from this Puritan idea that you're either good because you're one of God's chosen or you're not good. So you're constantly worried about how you appear. And it's kind of scary when you're growing up.
And you know, beyond the Puritan thing, I think it also people belong to a different time. I mean, I've certainly known people from the Midwest who are also so thrifty. And you give this great line of they saved on face cream, on scotch tape, on Christmas wrapping, on, you know, they baked Cheerios as cocktail snacks. Like they may have had $1 million, but they were not above saving 42 cents.
Oh, and they still are that way. And you know, looking back as you sort of get beyond it, compared to the nouveau kind of let's show everybody how much money we have, it's kind of great. But there is this sort of sense that they really sort of don't believe they have money. I can't really understand it. I've tried. But it's a very complex thing. And I, of course, as a result, I would never use one paper towel when I could use six. I mean, I just was terribly wasteful and very shocking. And my mother-in-law was very shocked by me because I would have like four open jars of mayonnaise in the refrigerator. And I was always just handing money out to my children. And Charlie said to me, "You must never talk to the children about money," because I didn't really have an understanding of it.
Charlie's your husband.
My husband, poor husband, has had to put up with me all these years.
Okay, so you grew up in this really frugal place. Like you said, people were always judging each other, sort of a typical New England thing. But like I said, I think there's other parts of the country that could identify.
Oh, sure.
What made you say, well, now that I've got, so you moved away, as you say. Well, let's start there, actually. Why did you move away? Why did you want to get out in the first place?
Well, I think I just sort of fled it. I was, you know, as one of these people that loved it in many ways, but I never felt I fit in. And I, you know what, I don't fit in anywhere, and I might as well realize that now. But, you know, I went to school, I went to New York, where it was really exciting because I could say outrageous things and not feel guilty or that I was a bad person all the time. Although, of course, being a New Englander, I know I'm a bad person. But there was a kind of a relief in that. But when I had children, I, you know, Concord really is one of those towns you can't get over. It is the most breathtaking. Well, you know, you're in Carlisle.
Yeah.
The most beautiful town. And people do come from the West Coast and they go, where's the real estate office? I am buying a house tomorrow.
It is really striking. And you feel like you're going back in time in the best possible way.
And you not only that, you actually, I mean, you feel as if Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott, all these people are kind of like your pals. And the kid who's playing soccer with your child is named Bronson because he actually is descended from Louisa May Alcott.
And we should say that Concord is the home, right, of Thoreau and of Louisa May Alcott and of Emerson. And I actually worked, if you can believe it, in Louisa May Alcott's orchard house, when I was growing up.
Oh, you
during
did?
The summer. Yeah, so, yes.
So tell me about that. Did you believe, as we all did, that that beautiful place was where Little Women actually happened? Because we all believed it was true, of course.
I'm sure I knew the truth because I was giving tours and I can't remember the tour at all. But I knew it super well then. I'm sure I knew, but
you didn't want to know.
But exactly.
You don't.
That's right. When you go into May's room and there's all the drawings on the wall that she did, it's very enchanting. So I'm sure I've covered that memory with with the fiction.
I'm the same way. I would go in, you know, every time people came to visit us, and I would just, you know, tears would well in my eyes as my daughter would be a little bored with it all. And I would just, you know, knowing full well that Beth was already dead by the time they moved in. But I didn't care. There was her piano. And it's sort of a miracle, not that Louisa May Alcott isn't a great writer, but that she has been such a successful writer for all these years, based on this story, which really wasn't true, but it was based on a longing for it to be true. And it really kind of works for that reason, I think.
And it was a story in a lot of ways that was sort of about the essence of hominess and thriftiness, right?
Right. And of course, her father, who made no money and lived off his wife and children, was a horrible spendthrift. So it's sort of ironic, and Louisa herself and her family moved almost 30 times. So there was a real sense, she was a very homesick person, all of them were, and it was partly because she wasn't sure the home was going to be there. The father wanted to be celibate, he wanted to leave the family, they were out of money, they were in this constant turmoil. And I think from that, she created this, and she only did it for the money. She didn't want to write the book. But halfway through the book, I think what happened was the wishful thinking became a little bit true. And the fact that her sister died, which is so powerful in the book, is almost directly from her journal. So it really became sort of a true story in its own way.
So you move back to Concord and you sort of have this longing to get back a little bit to history. You want your kids to take swimming lessons in Walden Pond where Henry David Thoreau was. And then you start to see.
They didn't want it. They had to be at a pool, of course. And of course, I hated swimming lessons at Walden Pond. And I was, you know, never got out of advanced beginners. I was such a terrible swimmer, but never mind.
And I'm sure it was freezing cold.
Freezing cold. They always get you swimming at every camp I've ever been to at like 8 a.m. before anything's warm.
Move back and you see a Concord and a New England in a lot of ways that is really changing, where the values are changing. What did that change feel like and how could you see it?
Well, it was sort of great because I came back, and you see, I'm just of terrible values myself. So I never judge people on any of this stuff because I know I would be doing it, you know, worser things than they. So that when I saw people building these just sort of outlandishly huge houses, I thought, you know, my New Englandness said, well, why do you need that much room? But then when I went to these houses, I was, you know, entranced by them because they were really kind of great. But they were taking over the farmlands, and, you know, it was it was a very strange thing. And then it started to get even worse because those were just sort of new people coming into Concord, and they wanted to have these houses, these big houses near each other because they were moving on into other, you know, their business would move them. But then finally, in I think around 2000 and something, the really big money came in, and that was almost, it was sort of great because these people had made their money, but it was sort of frightening because these beautiful old houses were being torn to the ground. So it was, and then things became more expensive in town, and so it was a little bit frightening, and it was, I think, really the first time it had happened that way, where sort of the old Protestants were being pushed out. So it was something that was a little frightening, but I don't think Concord in the end, I think it will stay what it is, and I'm glad it will.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we are talking to writer Sarah Payne Stewart. Her recent piece in The New Yorker is titled Pilgrim's Progress on God and Real Estate. And Sarah, you talked about these new big houses, and I'm going to read a description from your piece, which is just, it's sort of enchanting. This is what the new houses looked like. The houses were spacious, with media rooms and vaulted skylit hallways where the sun hit your face like a searchlight, and glass kitchen walls overlooking turquoise pools. I didn't want to like these houses, but what was not to like? No wonder the mothers and fathers in them beamed, so happy to see you when you trudged in to pick up your kids. They'd greet you in their Versailles foyer, ushering you to take a homemade brownie from the plate on the gleaming granite counter, the fathers bounding forward in expensive new gym clothes, the mothers a little worn but pretty, perfectly made up, like aging country and Western stars, with long, wavy, coiffed hair and a trace of a Southern accent.
The way I looked. I was there with my 12-year-old makeup, you know, looking really pretty bad because I was trying to look sort of decent on the one hand, so my parents would approve of me, but kind of shabby on the other. So, but they were really nice people. I mean, they were happy to be there, and I really liked them. But then a lot of them moved away. But that was really who my kids were playing with. And, of course, they were ugh about our house because we'd have the old bathrooms and things like that.
But you really, you know, you really notice that difference between, let's say, the way the women used to look, and then you talk about sort of blonde women in their 30s, you know, going on runs with their baby joggers, with bare midriffs and stuff. And that was, there was a real change in the feel of the town.
There was a change, and especially, of course, as you get into your 40s, as I was doing, or even 50 by then, anyone in their 30s seemed to be blonde. But these people had, you know, these little jogging outfits and landscape architects coming. And, you know, when I moved there, it was a lovely part of town, but the roads were all kind of gnarly and had holes in them. And it was just a really strange thing to see all these kind of new lawns coming in. And it was really amazing to watch something change in the space of four or five years.
How do you explain that change in values?
Well, I don't know. I think as I say in the piece, and I think I did it. The piece was cut so much I haven't dared read it, but I think the cut was a great cut, probably. But I think that there's just so much money, and if I had so much money, I can't tell you I wouldn't do that. I mean, I think it's tempting when the money comes so suddenly, the way it has in the last 7 years, not that I really understand money, it's fun to spend money and make a little sort of place for your children. But then it does get to be a little overboard.
Now, did you get a sense that there was a sort of constituency in town who was worried about houses getting torn down, older houses getting torn down and rebuilt with houses that were much, much larger and, like you said, had media rooms and just thousands more square feet in them?
Oh, yes. I mean, before I moved back to Concord, my parents said, oh, we just can't stand all these young people fixing up their houses and adding on to their houses. And that was in 1989. Then, of course, I came and became one of those people to a certain extent because I fixed up my house. But then when, you know, these explosions happened, you could just see everybody sort of walking their dogs, tisking around, and it was hard not to do it because there were some lovely houses there that, you know, one person told me a story that the people who bought the house had said how much they loved it and everything else. And the next day, they'd taken the house down to the ground.
And, you know, you've seen this in other places for years. I remember going to Los Angeles as a child, and we'd drive around Beverly Hills. And, I mean, they would, you know, raise houses with abandon. You know, it could be a beautiful house, and it would be taken down to the ground the next time. And they had very little sense of history. So Lucille Ball's house was taken down, and Jimmy Stewart's house was taken right down, and a bigger house was put up. But it always felt like that was the difference between, yes, let's say, California and Massachusetts.
Well, there's still a little sense of it. I remember one gorgeous house that I knew, and the people who bought it were very perfectly nice people who I think had come from Concord, but they had a lot of money, and they had please pardon our restoration. But as they said that in this sort of old-fashioned historical sign, outward going, you know, the all the stuff from the house was being thrown with splats into dumpsters, so you were a little afraid that maybe restoration wasn't the word we were looking for.
And you also talk about the sort of social expectations that came to town with the money. Talk a little bit about what block parties, the old-fashioned block party, used to look like, and then we'll move on to the new block party. But what did the old block party used to look like?
Well, this great friend of mine said, you know, you used to just walk your gin and tonic next door, and that was the block party. And then, you know, there were suddenly, you know, the same people that came and were building these houses were having magicians and ice cream trucks and invitations, and it was a much more, I'm sure the kids are much happier. It was much more kid-centric, but it was quite different from the walk your drink next door party.
Now, I know you moved around a little bit in Concord. Did you feel like because you were there in the 90s that you overextended yourself financially? I mean, it was sort of a time of getting easy credit.
Yes. My husband tells a story when we were deciding to buy this house, which we had no business buying, but of course I just fell in love with it. And he said he could never forget the mortgage guy saying, well, of course, there's no income verification. And he just looked at him and just thought, you know, that's it. We're buying the house. You know, we're terribly irresponsible.
And you moved into the second house that you lived in Concord, right? And my memory is that he didn't end up having an income for a year. It was a really tough...
He was a freelancer, and it was, you know, these things happen. You have these great years and these fallow years, and he had a fallow year. So it was not a good year to be buying something with a mortgage that was, you know, way more than we'd ever had before. So it was, and yet we still felt sort of that we were, you know, we just felt we were safe anyway because the house was so pretty and we felt kind of good for a while.
And, you know, you talk about so wanting to move back to Concord when you had children. Why did you eventually leave?
I think I left, of course, every day I have to be strapped down not to move back. So who knows? But I left, my parents died. And clearly there was a lot to do with them and me, that because when they left, things didn't have the same meaning and everything seemed sort of not the same. And then the children went to college. And I thought maybe it was time for me to leave my childhood. I don't know. I'm not sure. But so I moved, and I ended up moving to a town where, as it turned out, I'd been born. So I really haven't gotten over very much.
But it sounds like in your heart, you still really do like Concord.
I love Concord. Absolutely. In fact, somebody just sent me a house that was going on the market, and I had to suppress my desire to make an offer.
I think I would love if you would tell the story about the couple who you knew. So you sort of knew these two kinds of communities when you lived in Concord. And I would love if you would tell the story about the couple that you knew that, at the same time as other people are building huge places, they were kind of embarrassed about what they had. And so they're downplaying everything in terms of their kitchen and their selling price. What happened with that couple?
Yeah, there was a couple of different ones. There was one really great couple, and, you know, their kitchen was so big, and they just said, you know, we want it to be cozier. So they spent quite a bit of money to make it much smaller. And then there was another couple who a friend of mine knew well, and she just said they just couldn't bear what the house was worth, when they were told when they were selling it, so they just put it on for a lower price.
Do you get the sense that you sort of talk about the Protestant ethic. Now, I assume a lot of people who live in Concord are still Protestants, that it's not like their religion has changed. So what's happened to that sort of old school? And you particularly talk about Calvinism in the piece. What's happened to that old school ethic?
Well, I think a lot of it is still there. I think it's much more subtle. I don't think people think of it as God in Concord. I think it's sort of a feeling of being very liberal is sort of like replacing God and sort of having, you know, really, but it's still this sense that you're supposed, there's one faction, not the necessarily the new money, but there's a sense that you're supposed to be good and doing good for the world. And that's still in Concord. And it's very, I mean, I couldn't believe that everyone went to church when we arrived because none of my friends went to church, and it was just everyone was going to church, and it was a really big deal in Concord. And the new people, I don't really know a lot of the people that came in. They were coming in near the end of my time there, so I'm not really sure where that's who they are.
Did you?
But I think, yeah. I really didn't have anything to say.
Did you worry when all this new money came in, that both on the parent side and on the kids side, because, you know, obviously Concord is a lot of parents and kids, that on the parent side and the kids side, there was sort of judgment going around, or that you had something to measure up to that became increasingly tough to measure up to?
Well, it's a little more conflicted than that, because you don't want to be measuring up in one hand, but on the other hand, you get so upset that your children constantly like these houses and you want to sort of defend your house as being really very nice too. So you find yourself, without wanting to be, you know, sort of being a little competitive with these other people and trying to, you know, because of course the kids loved these new houses. They were much more fun for kids. So there is, you know, there is always a lot of conflict going on, I think, in New England.
And did there become sort of vacations and items, things that other people had that it might have been hard for you to get, but that the kids wanted?
Yes and no. What was nice is the kids went to public school, and the way it was in my day when I'd gone to public schools, there really was kind of a mix of people with money, without money. And, you know, there were lots of kids that didn't want to have a lot of money, that were embarrassed that they had the bigger houses. So it was kind of nice that way. I mean, the kids loved all the stuff, but they didn't seem to make judgments about it. And we always gave the kids whatever we could, which, you know, was very much looked down upon. We had huge, you know, I'd go to Toys R Us and you could give them, you know, a huge stocking for $50. So they never felt they, you know, I never really got why can't I have something from my kids. So I was lucky that way. But I think that was good. It was a good feeling in Concord that way, that some people had it, but they shared it, and it was okay.
I'm Kara Miller. We've been talking about real estate, the cost of change, and New England values with writer Sarah Payne Stewart. Her latest article for The New Yorker is titled Pilgrim's Progress on God and Real Estate. Sarah Payne Stewart, a fascinating article and a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Edgar Herwick is entering the studio, sort of, you know, dancing in a little bit.
And sauntering.
Exactly. And by the sound of this music, I think he may have something vaguely, is it Brazilian up your sleeve?
Hey, Kara. Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I think that this is exactly the sound that a lot of people imagine when they think about Brazilian music. Can we bring that up a little bit, Antonio?
I'm singing right along. Yeah. No, I'm not.
No, but, you know, they wouldn't be wrong. This is like a bossa nova 60s sound, and it's definitely part of the Brazilian music story, but it's only a part of it. And we're going to get into a very different side of Brazilian music. Plus, we're going to find out what all of that has to do with a giant, colorful mural that has been going up on the side of a building in Dewey Square.
Which I have seen.
Have you? What do you think of it?
It's very interesting. I need to get up closer. Every day, I actually see it as I'm commuting, and I'm like, what is that? I need to get closer to it, which I'm going to do this weekend.
You're about to find out.
I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and this is Boston Public Radio.
Agora você tem que me dizer como é que nós vamos fazer.